well as anyone else who wants to speak to those issues.
Okay. We have prepared a, as I've said, a spreadsheet which purports to compare what is in 257 in the bill last session and in 2898 this session. And that's available to members. And Ms. Diamond here is perhaps also perhaps to respond to questions about the spreadsheet. Let's see if there are any questions now about the amendments before us or the conceptual amendments proposed by Mr. Sandrock. Okay, if not, Mr. Gary, would you like, we have your written comments from Monday. We understand you didn't get notice or some conflicts around you will join us, but if you'd like to speak to the issue of consecutive sentence, glad to hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll answer questions. I guess I feel like Mr. Sandrock, we've been through this area so many times, I'm not quite sure where I would start.
Okay, well, let's open it to questions then, rather than another recitation of your position on this issue. Are there any questions for Mr. Gary?
Well, if not, Bill, if you want to be in a holding pattern here for a moment while we hear from Mr. Jacobson, who,
Steve, I know you're at somewhat of a loss because we've jumped around a bit on this issue and some of the materials have probably just been made available to you very recently, but we'd be glad to hear whatever comments you have.
Steve Jacobson from the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. Substantially, the bill is in the same form as it was in Senate Bill 257, which both Mr. Sandrock, Mr. Gary, and myself testified on a couple of weeks ago. The amendments that Mr. Sandrock mentions do address two of the issues that I brought up when I testified in the Senate, and I think those would probably be adequately taken care of. I guess I feel like I would like to ask Mr. Sandrock some questions about what he is going to draft with those.
Mr. Jacobson, we'll afford you every opportunity to work with counsel and Mr. Sandrock on that drafting exercise.
In a more general fashion,
sure.
I guess I'd like to make a few remarks about the bill. I gathered there was testimony here at a prior time that Mr. Sandrock did appear, and Mr. Gary, although I missed what just happened, I think he has submitted a written testimony that you probably have.
That's correct. We had some discussion. I'm not sure you were here to participate in that. During the discussion of the Victims' Rights Bill, 2594.
Right, and I was also out of town during that, so
right.
I guess I haven't at any point commented on this. I don't want to take a lot of time to do that now, because I know that we're trying to reach some kind of compromise on this, and I know the committee wants to take action. A couple things I want to point out, and these are things that I did bring up in the Senate side as well. I think that what Mr. Gary says is has happened with anti-merger consecutive sentencing, with the court trying to divine a legislative intent where the legislature never intended anything, is an accurate portrayal of the state of the law. And I sympathize with the judges and the lawyers and everybody who has to deal with this. But I think it's maybe grabbing the high ground to say that there was no law, and here we have standards that we put out that those are necessarily the best standards. And I have a few problems with the language that's used in trying to determine when there can be a consecutive sentence. In Section 2, which deals with consecutive sentences, the meat of it is subsection 4, A and B. Those are findings. One of those two findings has to be made before a person can be sentenced consecutively. And A deals with when a crime is not merely incidental to another crime. And then the language is used but rather was an indication of defendant's willingness to commit more than one criminal offense. My problem with that sentence is not in the concept of it. We want to find a way to describe a situation where one crime is, although there's a statutory violation, you can find it violates certain elements that have been defined by the legislature as a crime. It's incidental to the person's action. The problem with the language is that but rather was an indication of the defendant's willingness to commit more than one offense is not a logical but rather. We have to try to set up a continuum here of not this but this, and the two things are not part of the same line. The problem with the language that's chosen is that there's a few problems. First of all, it's so broad and so undefined that arguably any time a defendant or a suspect or somebody commits an act, it is an indication of their willingness to commit that act. So everybody who acts would come under this section. And so everybody could have a consecutive sentence on multiple offenses if they would comply with Section 5, which has yet to come. It may be that the solution to this is simply end the sentence before but rather. Just say you can have a consecutive sentence only if the court finds that the criminal offense is not merely an incidental violation of a separate statutory provision. I think it makes sense to do that. I'd be willing to listen to other language, but I don't think it makes sense to have the sentence as it stands. The other problem with the sentence as it stands is it kind of indicates a mental element that's going to be made as a finding by the court at sentencing. In other words, the defendant's willingness to commit more than one crime. And we've kind of been around the bend with that kind of a finding by a judge in the case of State versus Quinn, for example, where you have a death penalty statute where the jury finds an intentional homicide, intentional murder, and then the judge is given the duty of finding another mental element that's kind of similar, but it's different language. But the judge has to make that finding and then impose the death penalty if that and other findings are made. The Oregon courts ruled that unconstitutional under Oregon constitutional provision for right to jury trial, saying that that was a jury determination. My concern about leaving this willingness language in here is that you may be creating an issue, which as a defense attorney I would undoubtedly use, and I might win on, where you don't really need to. You don't really need to have that in there. So I guess my sense of foray is that probably we could find language that we could agree on, but the language there has those couple problems that I mentioned.
Okay, Mr. Sandrock, can I ask you to come forward to maybe respond? I don't know if you went through the same exercise on the Senate side, but is this something that I might be able to resolve?
Well, I don't know.
Strike the language.
Strike the language?
That he wants stricken. We can tell you why it's there, but strike it. It doesn't make any difference.
We didn't get to that point in the Senate. We had even less time than we had here.
Mr. Gary, you'd like to be heard on this?
Thank you. I don't have any problem with striking the language, but I think the committee should hear why the language is there. This particular subsection is intended to codify the concept that consecutive sentences are not a device that should be used based upon the nature of the offender, but rather should require an inquiry into the nature of the offense that was committed. And the concept that this section embodies, whether you use this language or some other language, is that where you have multiple offenses committed in the same course of conduct, you ought not to be making sentences consecutive if you have a person who is walking across several violations toward one central criminal objective. If, on the other hand, you have someone whose very conduct exhibits a willingness or a disregard for the fact that his conduct may transgress several different statutory provisions, that is a factor that ought to be weighed in favor of imposing multiple sentences on that offender. Now, I think the sense of that is clear enough, and what we're quibbling about is what language you include. Our intention in setting up the dichotomy that has been described to you was merely to complete the thought, and if the thought is complete enough to the committee's satisfaction, particularly in light of the legislative history that this bill will have now over three sessions, we're satisfied to strike out the last phrase as has been suggested. I also need to comment for the record regarding the other concern that was raised by Mr. Jacobson relating to the Quinn wedge problem of a judge making additional findings other than those which are found by a jury. Theoretically, that's a troubling concept. The argument, however, amounts to this. If you don't have any standards to guide the decision by the judge, you don't have a jury trial problem. But as soon as the legislature starts giving guidelines to control the exercise of discretion, then all of a sudden you run into problems with the right to jury trial. I don't think Quinn or Wedge go that far. And I think, in fact, that the test that was established in State versus Quinn and applied in State versus Wedge is that if you are adding an additional element to a crime, then the jury has to make the necessary factual finding. But judges make factual findings all the time in the course of imposing sentences, and that's perfectly appropriate. The only alternative is to go to a system that is completely a jury sentencing system, which I think would be bad policy and not mandated by the Constitution.
Okay, appreciate that comments. The chair is going to move to delete the language to which the parties have agreed to maybe delete it. I will allow the option, if parties wish and want to try to work on some language that might complete that statement and represents an agreement of all the parties here and want to present that to the full committee when it's up, we'd be glad to do that. But for the time being, the chair will present the motion to delete the language on line 4 on page 3 of the engrossed bill, beginning with the word but and through the word offense on line 5. Any objection? Not that language is deleted. Mr. Jacobson?
In section B of that same section, I guess we're on section 2, subsection 4B, the following section. This deals with the alternative finding that can be made, which would be preliminary to imposing a consecutive sentence. And it reads that the offense caused or created a risk of causing greater or qualitatively different loss, injury, or harm to the victim, or caused or created a risk of causing loss, injury, or harm to a different victim than was caused by the offense. My objection to this passage, again, is it's very vagueness and seemingly applicability to almost any kind of action that I can contemplate. Maybe it wouldn't be applied that way, but I just don't see very rational limits that can be put on this kind of language. If you talk about causing greater harm or injury, then the problems that I have with what is greater loss, what is qualitatively different loss, those problems, and I do have problems with that, but those problems pale when you get to talking not only about cause, but creating a risk of causing. Well, what is a risk? A risk could be anything. It could be an infinitesimal risk. Maybe that language needs to have a modifier of substantial risk. I'm just uncomfortable with that language. I would rather see us deal with actual actions, not with whether those actions might have caused a risk of something else happening. I don't think that this is particularly addressing any fact situation or particular cases. I think we're pretty much writing on a clean slate with this section. I may be wrong, and appreciate a response if I am wrong on that. But if that's what we're doing, and we're identifying people who we want to sentence more harshly than others, then it seems to me we want a fairly narrow category. And I would suggest starting with people who actually cause and perhaps actually intend to cause harm, not just people who create a risk of causing harm or who non-intentionally or recklessly create risks of causing harm to people that they didn't intend to harm. So I guess I would like to go on record as opposing the language in that section unless it can be substantially narrowed, or unless we hear some kind of legislative history about what is intended to be meant by it. There's a case that came down today from the Oregon Supreme Court declaring the legislative statute on burglars' tools unconstitutionally vague under the Oregon Constitution because they used the phrase tools commonly used to commit burglaries. Well, commonly used, we can debate about whether that's a good decision or not, but apparently when things don't have clear standards, they're going to be held up against a pretty strict test by the Oregon courts at this point in time. And I think this is the kind of language that, you know, judges and lawyers and everybody's going to look at this and say, what do we mean by greater loss? What do we mean by qualitatively different loss? Is there any kind of loss that's not greater or qualitatively different that could be additional to the loss that was caused by the actual crime? I just don't know where we're going with it. It seems to me it might very well be subject to that kind of challenge in addition to just not making much sense.
Okay. I think I understand your concern, Steve. Would they be addressed in part if we were to add language before risk where it appears on line 7 and 9 significant?
I think that would... significant or substantial, I think would improve it from my point of view. It doesn't obviously answer all my concerns.
For the proponents, Mr. Sandrock or Mr. Geary, would you have any problems with significant or substantial risk?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't think it makes a lot of difference. I don't think that the solution if I understand the concern that's expressed, it's that the language is new and it's untested and untried and somewhat amorphous, because we're talking about sentencing concepts which are essentially sociological in nature. I don't think the solution to that is to add another amorphous term like significant or substantial. I don't think it's going to make a lot of difference. The reason that the risk of harm language is there in the first place is because there are some crimes, such as attempted murder, where there may not be any harm caused by the commission of the crime. There is only a risk of harm. And if it satisfies the concerns of Mr. Jacobson and the committee to add significant, I don't think that does any violence to the concept.
Well, I'm not sure if this section intends to create the possibility of punishing people for behavior, consecutively sentencing them, for behavior where the harm is not intended. In other words, where you're dealing with reckless or criminally negligent behavior. I think that's more my problem, that unless maybe the mental element, or if we talk about people like in the attempted murder situation where you're trying to kill somebody, it's an intentional act that we're talking about. If in that situation you create a risk by what you do of harming another individual or with greater loss or different loss, then I think we've identified a group of people who might be appropriate to punish more severely. If we're talking about somebody who acts recklessly, in other words, not with a specific intent to harm other people, but with a disregard for who or what they're going to harm, then it seems to me we might not want to treat them the same way. And perhaps this upon reflection, perhaps this section does relate to the State versus Lopez case of the drunk driver causing several injuries by ending up ramming into a car with more than one person in it. I think under the scheme of this whole statute, that person would be have separate convictions under the anti-merger sections and would be able to be consecutively sentenced under this section. And I'm not sure that if that's the policy choice the committee wants to make, I want the committee to be aware of it, because I'm not sure that that is the appropriate policy choice.
Okay, so you would feel, are you treating intentional and reckless conduct differently? Would you like to see them treated differently?
I think I would. I don't have a good solution for doing it with this concept, with this language.
Okay, well, let's move back to the maybe easier, if less, if somewhat facile point of including the word significant or substantial risk. I think I heard Mr. Jacobson say that that might take a small step towards resolving some of his concern with this subsection, and I think I heard Mr. Gary say it probably really doesn't matter. I don't know what the amalgam of that opinion is in terms of intent if we adopt that kind of language, but let me just go ahead and make the motion that where risk appears on lines 7 and 9, we, before that word, we include the word substantial risk of causing loss, injury, or harm. Is there any objection to that amendment? If not, be adopted. Mr. Jacobson, I appreciate your comments. We're a little bit at a loss to try to respond, I think, without some language before us. Or I would be glad, speaking for myself, if the committee takes action or subcommittee takes action on this measure and moves it to full committee, to allow you an opportunity to submit some language for consideration before the full committee. Just because I sense that we want to try to get moving on this today if we can. Did you want to speak to some further provisions here in the amendments before us?
Well, I think with the anti-merger section, which is section 4 of the amendments before you, the amendments that Mr. Sandrock has spoken to, I think, basically address my concerns with section 1 and with section 2 that I expressed previously. I think they're going about it backwards if the amendments are going to attempt to focus on property crimes and exclude them from the effect of this section. It seems to me that in the case of a burglary, and the intended crime therein, nobody has any problem with saying that there's really only one offense unless you're dealing with a crime against a person, particularly a situation where a rape is charged. That's the only kind of horror story that I've heard that has any real appeal and makes any sense, that there's a problem with merger in that situation as far as the equities. I understand philosophically that maybe there shouldn't be any merger, and there's arguments for that. So maybe the best way to handle that in amending it is simply to say that when the intended crime is a crime against a person, in other words, a crime in Chapter 163 of ORS, for instance, which is crimes, offenses against persons, then the offense may, there may be as many separately punishable offenses as statutory violations. That would be a way of handling it that I think would address everybody's concerns without worrying about naming each kind of different property crime.
Okay, that's more a difference in style or approach than a substantive difference in the actual policy.
I think so, although not seeing the language that, I know that they've only talked in concept so far.
Okay, well, again, I would reserve for you, at least from my perspective, if in that process of drafting, taking the concepts that we've adopted, and in the draft, if you want an opportunity to address that issue or take the other approach,
okay.
You may have that opportunity.
My other concern was in the final section of the anti-merger, where there appears to be a difference between what was arrived at in the last session and what has ended up in Senate Bill 257. I didn't have an opportunity to study this in great detail, but apparently at the end of the 83 session, the language that dealt with the criminal defendant having an opportunity to renounce the criminal intent was something that people involved believed was something that should be submitted to the trier of fact. And I think it was probably in response to the concern about the judges making findings with regard to defendant's intent. It's probably that concern, although I wasn't involved in this in the last session. That's been taken out, and my concern about that would be that you may be passing a law that will fold. I think Mr. Gary's already expressed his view that would not be the case, and maybe that's why it was taken out, is that the Department of Justice's view is that will withstand constitutional challenge. But I want to bring that up.
Okay. Mr. Gary or Mr. Sandrock, do you want to respond or explain your position further?
No.
Okay. Mr. Groom, I know you've joined us. Do you want to make any additional comments on this issue?
Mr. Chairman, Dave Groom with the Criminal Defense Lawyers, I don't really have anything further as far as, I believe the amendments that we talked about earlier today with Mr. Sandrock cleared up what the membership of our organization was concerned about, basically. And at this point, I don't think the organization has any significant objection to the bill as it stands.
Okay. Representative Kopetsky?
I'm just trying to sort through all this. We have a rigid rule now in terms of merger of multiple victim offenses in this. Is that, I think we've gotten there. I guess Mr. Jacobson would ask you that question.
I'm not sure I understood the question.
Well,
I'm sorry.
And State v. Kessler, the court said that there was not expressed legislative intent in this area. Do you think that we've accomplished the suggestion, I guess, from the Supreme Court?
I think the legislature will have expressed intent. I don't think it's the intent of the framers of this bill to have every hypothetical answered by the legislation. I think it's their attempt is to produce standards for judges to apply. I guess I like to think of the law in terms of results. What is going to happen when there's a robbery that's committed? Person has a gun in their pocket, but they use a knife, so they committed one robbery, and there's two different ways. How will this law affect them? I don't think that they've gone at it and expressed any intent on those various different hypotheticals that they could come up with.
But the standards are there. That's pretty clear that everybody's going to understand out there in Harney County and Multnomah County.
And insofar as you can understand the language, when I read section 2.4 sub 4 sub B, I don't know how that's going to be applied. I don't have the faintest idea how it's going to be applied. That's why I don't like it. I don't know what you will mean when you vote yes on it.
That's okay. We're not sure what he means when he votes. Unless he tells us that.
And I, you know, I do see that as a problem.
Could I ask Mr. Sandrock and Mr. Gary if they want to add or subtract from that?
Pete Sandrock, Oregon District Attorneys Association. It's our view that this will give the courts what they've been asking for, and to the extent that we have been able to divine with any particularity Justice Lindy's special views in this area, we've tried to address those.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kopetsky, I think the answer to your question is yes, you will have done what the court asked you to do in Kessler and in other cases. And Mr. Jacobson is right to a certain extent. There are questions that will remain. What this bill does is start the courts down the right track. It starts asking the right questions. It separates the question of how many convictions should be entered from the question of what is the appropriate response in terms of sentence to the entire course of criminal conduct. And that's a tremendous first step. There will be additional court decisions, but the court will be grappling with the application of criteria that reflect in some principled way what the legislature is saying judges should consider in making the punishment.